I have
current geek.
Hello and welcome to the Current Geek Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest films of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt.
Well, hello, Scott.
Hi, Tom. This week we're talking about the movie It Happened One Night, see?
Why, that's an incredible romantic comedy that I saw in my local theater just the other day. My local theater, I mean the television in my living room.
The cinema. I went down to the cinema. The movie house. The picture show.
It's a hell of a picture, Scott.
We are definitely pulling from that era, everybody. 1934's It Happened One Night, a film I had no familiarity or knowledge of previous to our decision to watch this for this show. So, my first time, Tom. Your first time, too, though, right?
Yeah, my first time, too. This is our second Frank Capra film in the Current Geek Film Festival. Yep. It was released February 22nd, 1934. Screenplay by Robert Riskin, based on a short story by Samuel Hopkins Adams called The Night Bus, or rather just Night Bus, no the. And it's very loosely based on that, in that there is a bus that goes at night at the beginning of the story. I didn't know much about this. I had heard it bandied about as sort of the prototype rom-com, the thing that set the template. It was homaged, I don't know if I'd say remade, but it was homaged several times over the years. But people often credit Frank Capra, Claudette Colbert, Clark Gable with sort of the modern romantic comedy. Not that there weren't romantic comedies before 1934, but that formula of the two strangers, one who's already committed to someone who maybe she doesn't really love, and then they fall for each other, but they can't, and they're separated, and at the end they come back together. That all happens in It Happened One Night.
I will not claim to be a guy who has seen every iteration of a romantic comedy. I can say...
I don't think anybody can claim that.
No, there are a few people who I might look at and think maybe they have, but
pretty close. Yeah.
But for the most part, it's a pretty rare thing. I will say, though, of all the ones I've seen, and I've seen most of the big ones because, you know, you just your wife wants to see him. I'm not trying to make a stereotype. I'm just saying she's really into it. I'm not. So she knows what's coming. If the 27 dresses, for all I know, is about 27 different dresses, but it's about a lot more than that, she says. We should sit and watch it.
Made in Manhattan. O-M-A-I-D.
Another one. Yeah, oh, and there's always this class difference I've noticed. Sometimes it's the man, sometimes
it's
the woman.
Yes, and that is present here and It Happened One Night as well.
Yeah, and it is the template, like straight up the template. And to know that it existed in 1934 and in what I think is one of the, I mean, it's a really well-made, well with the exception when people yell, but that's always true of movies in the 30s. But it's a really well-made and produced movie that doesn't feel as old as the year you're telling me it was made in.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I mean, it is odd sometimes that there's no television, right? Mm-mm. Like that hadn't been invented yet. So everything's happening on the radio and newspapers. But even as old as it is, nothing feels like so outdated that you can't wrap your head around it, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like you couldn't adapt this very easily into the modern day.
Right, not at all. But it does.
The themes are universal, which is, I guess, the thing with Frank Capra.
Somehow it works. Somehow it is the template. And now I'm going to think of it every time I see Hitch or freaking... It doesn't matter. They all have bits of it. All of them have lifted parts of it and used it. And so I don't know that I would... I guess you could say, well, then Capra and company are geniuses because they invented a brand new subgenre for film and it persists to this day and endures. Sure, maybe. Or it seems like most of these themes were inevitable and it was just a matter of somebody putting it into an hour and a half in its completion and getting all the parts right. Maybe that's all they did. I don't know. But
I have a theory. Based on some of the facts we'll talk about that we've collected here to tell you about today, I have a theory that the tension between the studio, Capra, and the actors caused a balance they couldn't have planned for between Capra's optimistic and sometimes cheesy point of view and a more realistic point of view, while still going towards a typical Capra happy ending.
Yes.
Which I call it a Capri ending.
A Capri ending.
Because neither Clark Gable nor Claudette Colbert were the first choice to play these roles. Colbert had sworn she would never work with Frank Capra again after having a horrible experience on For the Love of Mike back in 1927. And Gable, by all accounts, didn't really want to be there. He was lent to Columbia Pictures. This is back in the old studio system when the actors were tied to the studios. He was lent to Columbia Pictures. Some people say as a punishment for being too picky about roles, though that's been disputed. Capra did say that Gable was reluctant, though. And Gable and Colbert both, by all accounts, were dissatisfied with the quality of the script. And Capra took that into account and let Robert Riskin sort of rewrite it with their input involved.
I mean, they had to all be pleased at the end because they won all five major Academy Awards that year, which is a relatively new thing, an institution at that point. But still, like...
Well, and it's the first one to do it. We've talked about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as being... the other one, when we watch that, we will eventually watch the other one, I think, Silence of the Lambs, with the most recent one to get all five. All five, because screenwriting is split between adaptation and original.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's an adaptation. You never see anybody get original and adaptation because you can't. It's the script is either adapted or it's not.
Right. So. You have it's a pretty binary choice
when
those happen. But I always like to hear that there was some troubled production in a movie that I end up seeing and really liking, because it usually means either there was a greater vision happening and those involved in the day-to-day work of it couldn't see it until the full package was complete. A good example of that recently would be Mad Max Fury Road. And I know I bring it up a lot, but I just want to say this one thing about it.
Never heard of it. I should watch it one of these days.
I was reminded the other day that they, on set anyway, were having all kinds of fights and stuff between cast and some crew and all kinds of grumbly rumblies. And all people involved have since apologized and were so honored to be in such a cool production, and as they should be. But this is another case of that where, you know, people were reluctant, or they didn't like the story, or she was wary of the director because For the Love of Mike sucked, or whatever. But in the end, here's the other thing I came away with. I've never seen a Clark Gable movie. First time. Okay.
Oh, you've never seen Gone with the Wind?
Nope. Never.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That'll come up, I'm sure, on this list. It has to be on.
Yeah, it's down there a ways, but yeah, it will.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Like, that's all I know that from is the fun people have with it, and that's it. And so I've really had no experience with him. My experience with him from afar has always been, dude, that mustache sucks. Why do you have that mustache? That's a terrible mustache. I always thought he was a lot older than he was. I mean, the guy died at 59. He wasn't that old, but he always looked in his 50s, even when he was in his late 20s.
A little bit like Bogart, who also died young.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Just kind of always looked the same age, no matter when you saw him.
That's like cigars or drinking or what does that to you, but genetics, I don't know. But he is really good in this. Like, legitimately, I came away going, oh, I get it. I get why that guy was a star. And not only that, I mean, because I haven't seen him in other stuff, I don't know what to compare it to, but there was a real just sort of natural and loose quality to his acting in this that didn't feel like the stiff sort of stagey thing that I associate with most 30s and 40s productions. Mm-hmm. And that blew
me
away.
Still closer to films just being adapted stage plays. Right?
Yeah, so exactly.
That inertia is kind of still present in a lot of performances. And you see that in some of these performances in the character actors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sets off Gable's talent in comparison.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I don't know why I didn't expect it, but that came as a nice surprise. And I could see why he was such a leading man and so in demand for so many years. I totally get it now. She was also great. What was weird is that back then, movies would deal with people's lives when they were in, like, they were like mature, fully formed adults by 21, you know? So she's playing 21, just over 21.
Yeah, there's children and there's adults.
Yeah.
That's it.
There's no
and old people, right? Because the father's kind of in the old person category.
Yes, exactly. And there's nothing else from them. And I don't know if society was more like that, or if, you know, you look back at it like old Civil War photos and you're like, ah, this general, a storied seasoned general who saw so many fights and battles in this. And I'm like, well, how old was he? Well, he was 22 when this shot was taken, and 25 he was dead, you know? Like, you're like, what the heck? So she was like that a little bit in this movie for me, this very mature, I don't know what kind of the good description for her, but she's, you know, all these things, opulent, and she's comes from this rich family and all this, and she's 21. And I'm like, oh, freaking 21. You're old enough to go to Vegas and drink, I guess, you know? Like, it doesn't jive with me. My daughter's 21, for example. I can't think of her and this lady in the same context, not just because it's old and in black and white, but because it's just a different norm and we've changed, and plus people get older now and, you know, whatever.
I do think there's something about Claudette Colbert's character that informs Ellie really well, because she is playing someone who is rich and somewhat inexperienced in the ways of the rabble, right? But willing to do what she needs to do to get what she wants. And we think at the beginning of this that what she wants is to go marry King. Mm. And so she needs to get across the country, and she'll, by golly, if as rich as she is, she'll get on the night bus and to do it and risk everything. And she talks about how fun it was to get away from her bodyguards when she was young. And there's that classic 30s, like, class disparate conversation with her and Clark Gable. But I think one anecdote from the filming sort of shows that Colbert was kind of that person herself, because she initially would not do the scene where she pulled up her skirt to entice the passing driver to give them a ride when they were hitchhiking, saying it was unladylike. But then when they brought a chorus girl out as a body double, she got outraged and said, get her out of here. I'll do it. That's not my leg.
I love it. Sassy early Hollywoods, man. Just, that's not my leg. I'll do it. See, I put it at the end again. But
and that scene, just since we're talking about it, I mean, how many times have you seen that scene parodied? It Happened One Night.
I have no idea.
I'm sure it wasn't the first time anybody had done that, show a little leg. But this is the famous one. This is the one that everybody knew.
Well, it suddenly clicked. I saw it and went, oh, all of those things, the cartoons. Like the Warner Brothers stuff of the time, which I
should we talk about?
Well, you know what? We ought to talk about that, because
influence here.
It's alleged, but I love it. So yes, Tom sends me this text and got me even more excited about this movie. So tell me the connection.
So allegedly, Mr. Avery, you may know him as Tex.
Tex Avery, one of the great animators of all time. Tex Avery.
Yeah, was a huge fan of this movie, and people think that Bugs Bunny is based on Clark Gable's character in this movie, Peter, particularly when right before she shows the leg, he's eating carrots quickly and talking at a rapid pace. Although some people point out that Shapley, the guy on the bus who's trying to hit up Ellie, and then Peter comes over and say, hey, that's my wife. Scram, buddy. He calls Peter Doc. And so it may not be based particularly on the character of Peter, but a lot of people think that Bugs Bunny was pulled from this movie. And that showing the leg to stop the car is definitely a Looney Tunes move.
Oh, it happened all the time in Looney Tunes, and multiple times.
So you got carrot eating, you got fast talking, you got somebody calling somebody Doc, and you got, you know, showing a little leg to stop a car. I mean, it's quite a coincidence.
Yeah.
It's
not true. And Tex Avery in particular would employ that technique a ton, like in his droopy cartoons, in all sorts of stuff. So I'm going to go ahead and believe it's all true, even if it's only alleged at this point and not 100% proven out, because that's one of those, even if it's urban legend, one I'd like to embrace. Well, that's awesome. And also I can just totally see it. And why not? Like most of those shorts, the Warner Brothers,
Fritz Frehling. I said it was Tex Avery. It was Fritz Frehling.
Oh, Fritz Frehling. He did more Looney Tunes stuff. So that would make sense.
He inspired parts of, he says, or apparently It Happened One Night inspired parts of Bugs Bunny for Fritz Frehling. I apologize for saying it was Tex Avery to Tex Avery and his estate.
That's fine. I have a really good book about Tex Avery that everybody should read. It's fantastic.
Fritz Frehling.
Nothing wrong with Fritz Frehling.
Who did all those things that I just said.
He's also great. Him and mind just went blank, but basically the greatest Warner Brothers short animator of all time, whose name eludes me. also use this technique. So here's what I think. Early Hollywood influenced early Hollywood animators. And they were always having walk-ons by people like Clark Gable. In fact, that's maybe the first ever Clark Gable-ish thing I ever saw was probably a Looney Tune where he wandered in on scene, one of those ones where they just kind of have a cavalcade of stars and Jimmy Cagney and freaking...
And Looney Tunes were developed to play before movies.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd want to parody the movies that people had seen and get them to laugh because they'd been to the movies previously, you would expect, and would have seen those things and get the jokes.
Yeah, I totally think that all holds up. I do think, though, I mean, as much as it's a famous moment, you know, nobody does those anymore where they stick their leg out in the freeway or whatever. I mean, I guess you could have I mean,
arguably nobody ever did. It's just in a movie, right?
Right. But I mean, even in movies, you might have somebody step out of a car who's just gorgeous and, you know, various states of not necessarily 100% clothed or whatever, and that stops traffic. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like a trope you're less likely to see today.
Well, there is that one famous scene. What's her name? Furiosa steps out and stops all of the Mad Max trucks. Am I remembering that wrong?
I think you are. I think she used a truck.
Maybe I'm remembering that.
She used an actual truck to stop a bunch of trucks. And
that's what it wasn't a leg. It was an actual truck. Yeah. Never mind.
I mean, I don't know how many times it's been now, but I literally watched that movie again this week because I'm weird. Because I'm weird. I know. I get it. I'm weird.
You love it. You love it.
I did. I ended up watching right after I watched Road Warrior from 1981, which is also George Miller. It's also Mad Max, but that's old stuff's not even on the same plane as this new thing. It's not even close. Anyway, sorry. Detour. That movie's great. You should go watch it. And you should watch this movie, which, by the way, I had to rent on Amazon Prime. So it's not as readily available as I wish it was. Sometimes our movies, we get lucky and they're streaming on some service that's popular. Is that how you got it? How'd you nail it?
I actually bought it. Mm. I just bought it from on my Apple TV because I think it was only $9.99. And I was like, this is one of the greatest movies of all time. It's got Clark Gable in it. Why not? Yep. I'm going to splurge and just buy it and have it. And I'm glad I did because I think I might throw this on one day when I'm sick or something and just need to have something pleasant because the patter is just soothing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that it's a good story with good acting and yet still has that 30s patter that is a thing that I mean, it definitely, as much as we said, like the story holds up to a modern viewing, the feel of everything, the aesthetic is very 30s.
Oh yeah. Like just the height of his pants. Like, that's a small thing, but it's all, every time I noticed it, every time he had to go change clothes, which happened a lot in this movie, felt like, back in the day, they wore him up to here, and they got the crazy suspender unit deals, and their shoes have some kind of weird clip-on suspender things happening, and everyone's driving Model Ts and stuff, or whatever they were at the time. I don't know what equivalent.
Yeah, those open-top cars and everything.
Yeah, it was just, it's a thing of its time. Columbia, the film, the studio, according to the notes, did not believe in it much, and therefore did not advertise it.
Another example. How many times have we watched a Current Geek Film Fest movie, and it's like, yeah, won all the Academy Awards. Nobody believed in it. They all thought it would suck.
Yeah. So what was it all?
It's
word
like
of
half
mouth.
And half.
Was it word of mouth? Was it like that sort of thing that drove its popularity? Because it got pretty popular pretty quick.
Well, the critics liked it. But the first run in the big cities was just average, you know, and that's exactly what Columbia thought. They're like, we're not going to waste a lot of money advertising this because, you know, it's going to get a few people, whatever. But back then you'd have the big release in the big cities, you'd release it out into the secondary market. And that would be places like, I don't know, Greenville, Illinois. I mean, I know we used to not get the movies the same time you'd get them in St. Louis. You'd have to drive into St. Louis to see them even back in the 70s. So during that secondary run, word of mouth began to spread and the ticket sales started to pick up, especially in the smaller towns where the film's characters and romance kind of struck a chord with moviegoers because they weren't surrounded by big luxury. So when they saw them on the bus or walking around in the countryside, sleeping in hay, people are like, yeah, okay, this movie's a little more familiar to me. And it turned out to end up being a box office smash, probably one of Colombia's biggest, if not their biggest, by, you know, if you adjust for inflation to date.
Yeah, and the way things work today, if a movie does a similar arc, it's almost always crapped out in the theater, quickly moved to video, and then finds new life on video, or whatever that is. Now it's streaming, used to be DVD.
The secondary market of the small towns have been replaced by airplanes and on demand and all that.
Yeah, exactly. So I got, so here's my fun little trivia question for you that I didn't tell you about before, so this is totally on the spot. Do you have a favorite movie that tanked in the movie theater, but then later either resonated with you more on video, or because you discovered it there, or because it got popular and you heard about it there? Like, do you have a favorite movie like that that stunk it up in the theaters but kind of killed it at home? Because I got one.
Yeah, like a movie that later got the accolades it deserved. I mean, the first one that pops to mind is The Princess Bride, which did just kind of okay in the movie theater and became a cult classic.
To this day, that thing is still like huge with everybody.
That thing is much bigger now than it was back then.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, and that is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
That's but I'm trying to think back through my favorite movies, and I can't think of a ton of examples where they weren't just old movies that I never would have seen. Like Road to Bali with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby is one of my favorite movies. It's a silly movie. I rarely ever share it with anyone because I like it almost entirely for nostalgia reasons of watching it with my family growing up. It doesn't hold up very well. But also that was not a movie I saw, and I can't say that it was a flop in the theaters. So,
for me, a more modern example would be 1999's The Iron Giant. That thing came out in theaters, published, or the studio at the time was Warner Brothers. This was Brad Bird's first theatrical film direction since he was doing all kinds of shorts and little stuff. And this is way before Pixar, of course. So that thing comes out in 99 and flopped in theaters. It just didn't go anywhere. I don't know if it was bad advertising. I don't know what happened, but that is one of the greatest animated films ever made. And most people didn't know it till, you know, 3 years later when they caught it on VHS tape at their friend's house or something, or maybe DVD a little bit later, but it was such a freaking awesome movie. Like, it's the best movie of that year. The chat room says Shawshank Redemption. I think Shawshank did fine in theaters for what it was.
Yeah, I don't remember it being considered a flop.
No.
I mean, and there's two kinds of flops, right? There's the box office flop and there's the critical flop.
Right. And then there's the critical mistakes. Like, that year, Forrest Gump got Best Picture, and it's very arguable that that should have gone to Shawshank Redemption. In fact, all these years later, everyone still says,
although that's not a critical mistake, that's an Academy mistake.
Exactly.
Two different things.
Exactly.
The Academy is made up of people in the industry, not critics.
Yeah. And yeah, like Iron Giant, they said it's better than Superman, Man of Steel, without a question. It knows, Iron Giant knows more about what Superman is supposed to be than all those Superman movies recently put together. And it's a fantastic freaking movie, but it reminds me that things aren't always going to just, if they don't explode in theaters, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It could mean something. It could mean it was garbage, but a lot of times it ends up being, oh my gosh, that's a film I could watch anytime. I would put it up in my top 10 of all time movies. And if I based it just on how it did in the box office, it'd be on the bottom 100. Or lower, you know, like it just didn't do very well. But anyway.
There was that little sci-fi film from the 70s called The Star War.
Oh, The Star War. Yeah. Yeah, I heard of it.
That was kind of a flop. No, I'm trying to think. Like, you know what? Actually, I will say the one that, I don't know that it was a flop, but it's not considered to be a huge box office success. And you don't see it making the rounds anymore, is The Black Hole.
Oh, I love The Black Hole. Are we going to watch The Black Hole?
When we were talking about the picture of The Black Hole, the first picture ever of a black hole.
Yeah.
I loved that movie. I don't know if I'd love it now. I haven't rewatched it in a long time, but I almost don't want to because I just have such pleasant memories of, I watch it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. I remember being very controversial.
It was on HBO and then it was on, then it was available for rental. And I think we bought it. I think my parents had it on VHS and, we watched it a lot.
Yeah, we did too. We had it on VHS as well. I remember it being controversial, and there was a time there where my parents wouldn't let me watch it because there was some scene in it where, I don't remember his name, but the evil
Maximilian.
Maximilian was like grinding somebody up with a with his blades.
I used to frighten my brother.
Oh, right. You talked about this on DTNS.
Yeah, I talked about that on Good
After
Day
Show or something. So yeah, black hole, man. That's a maybe an example of it. But the point is, like, you know, a movie like this, it always just seems like the. It's true of other movies we've watched for the series. I want to say that the Rosebud movie. I can't think of it.
The Rosebud. I love that Citizen you call Kane. Citizen Kane the Rosebud movie.
Sorry, the Citizen Kane was also riddled with Rosebud problems.
Movie. You know what I'm talking about.
They had all kinds of issues.
Let me just spoil the ending. Actually, it's the very first thing you see, so it's not really spoiling unless you say what Rosebud is. So
yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. I feel like I can get away with it because it's so old, but you know, it's like saying, what's that Bruce Willis movie where maybe he's dead the whole time? You know, that's a bad way to introduce a film. But yeah.
What's that one that's made of people?
Exactly. So, Soylent Green, we should watch. Anyway, we shouldn't watch that because it's not one of the greatest films ever made, but you're making me want to watch these bad movies.
Don't think it does. I don't think it's one of the greatest. I don't.
No. No way Soylent Green is on that list. No. It can't be. I mean, I want it to be, but it won't be. So it'll have to live in Film Sack Town. But anyway, this is a number of movies that we've watched for this series have troubled productions. The leadership at the studios who aren't confident about it or demand reshoots or don't like how it's written or, you know, the cast is frustrated while they're making it. There's
I think that's
there.
Why we get a lot of the stereotypes is because we hear about these stories about famous movies like this, right? So this feels like the template, not only for a romantic comedy, but a template for the story of the diva actors who put their foot down and get upset, right? Mm. That's what the backstory sounds like.
Yeah. And that's, it's probably true. Probably every production is full of issues because that's the whole point of it being a production. It's hundreds of people, thousands of man hours. Everything can go wrong.
But I think most of the stuff we watch, or the backstory, doesn't include some horrible like fight.
Yeah,
amongst
that's
the cast members.
Yeah, that's
Although
true.
The older movies do tend to. I've started to notice that the older a movie is, the more likely the actors are upset. And I wonder if that relates to the studio system.
Mm.
Where they just didn't feel like they had any control over what they did. And so they had to act out in some other way to exercise that control because they're being forced to be on these movies because the studio owns them, basically.
As a business structure, do you think the studio system had merit? Like, not to invoke your last name for no reason, but do you think it has any kind of... Do you think there was any...
I think it had Johnson.
A good volume of Johnson. No, was that ever a good idea, or was that always doomed to fail, or not fail, but go away? Like, we've never really talked
about
that.
I think about it, and it is the same logic behind sports teams having their players on contract.
Yeah.
And saying, you can only play with my sports team. And in a way, if you think about it from that respect, think about it from the current situation, right? Mm. Not the old sports team situation, but the current situation where a player signs a contract and says, I will be a member of your sports team for 5 years, after which I'm a free agent.
Mm.
I mean, that was the studio system. Yeah, actors weren't signed for life usually.
Mm-hmm.
They were usually signed for a number of years. It may be a large number of years. I may be misunderstanding the studio system, so I should back off on saying that. But the idea was, you know, you're replaceable.
Mm-hmm.
You're talent, and so we want to lock you up. We don't want you flitting around because it's bad for business.
Right.
And I think I'm trying to wrap my head around it because I don't know enough about the studio system, and I don't want to walk into saying something that's wrong because I think I already have. But but what I will say is, from the business point of view, being able to lock up the talent is a mindset that says, I want to win over all my competitors. There's not room for all of us. I want to have the best actors. But there is also the business reality of sometimes I won't be able to employ them best, and I can make a little money by lending them out.
Mm.
And if we all do that, then we all benefit. But it's all at the benefit of the business. And what breaking down the studio system did was say, hey, give the actors some control.
Yeah, and put them in charge. They're the ones with the power, sort of.
That can be abused by actors who are big and powerful and demand huge box offices, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But all in all, I think in general, it benefits not only the actors, but the studios because, and the viewers and the people who go to the movies, because we now get to see more combinations of actors and the best actors for a part get to be considered. And often more actors will be used because you're not just using somebody because you already had them on contract. Mm-hmm. You'll go out and try to find somebody new or fresh. I think on the whole, it's 99% better to not have that old studio system. I think all the reasons for having it were reasons that benefited Henry Mayer and other people sitting up in the offices.
Yeah. Mr. DeMille and those people. Yeah, I think I agree with you. And it reminds me of current day issues with different kinds of exclusives now. Like then it was people were exclusive to you. These days it's content is exclusive to you. And that sometimes wins format wars, platform wars, that sort of thing, in video games, in streaming services.
Yeah, there's a weird way to think about it. Like, okay, if a particular developer is a superstar developer and he's an employee of Electronic Arts, and Electronic Arts is saying, okay, you're with us and you're contracted with us, and if you leave us, you can't go work for a competitor for a certain amount of years. I mean, that's kind of the same thing.
That's what they do, yeah. I mean, they kind of do. And then the content itself is, you know, right now we're watching this. Who knows if it's more of a tempest in a teapot than the gamers are making it. But this Epic Store versus Steam thing is very much feels like the studio system where the games themselves are the actors.
Are the actors, yeah.
But in some cases, the actors are the ones that are throwing the power around.
But the games aren't exclusive to the studio.
They're
in that analogy.
They're timed exclusive. Yes,
they're timed exclusive. Yeah. But also like the next, and the weird thing is you can't really make them actors because they can't appear in another movie. They are that game.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Well, so I guess
the analogy kind of breaks down there.
I guess so. But they also, in theory, could be though. They could say, hey, our game, the developers of Metro, the new Metro game, for example, they could say, well, look, we're exclusive for 6 months here on Epic, but also we have this smaller indie game that we made, and we're just going to put that on Steam, GOG, and everywhere else. It's day one, and that comes out next week.
Yeah, the game studio, which mm-hmm. is if you make the game maker the actor, that makes more sense. And in that case, it's not the same at all, because even though one game may have a limited exclusive one place, the other games they make can go anywhere. And even that game is only limited exclusive. It's going to show up everywhere eventually. Yeah.
Plus, it was a simpler analogy in the 30s with film than we have now, because the layers and who gets paid in video games, like the Voice Actors Guild is super pissed all the time and don't get the recognition and money they deserve. And so there's like little mini battles all up and down the chain. Whereas in Hollywood, it was just, I mean, I'm talking out of my lane here too a little bit, but it seemed like it was just, you're our actor and you'll work here. See? And that was just the way it worked. And if you got out of there, it was because you were lent to somebody and or you did something super rebellious or whatever. Well,
and that brings us back around to my idea that what makes a great movie is almost unpredictable.
Right.
I don't know that anyone can make a great movie intentionally, like a great movie. I'm not just talking about a good movie. There's lots of ways to make a good movie. But to make a great movie intentionally may be impossible. Because Frank Capra, as great as he is, not every movie he made was great. And it's a weird amount of circumstances that cause It Happened One Night to be as good as it is. He doesn't want Gable and Colbert to start with, right? But he ends up with them. Mm-hmm. Gable and Colbert didn't really want to do the movie, but through a series of unfortunate events, they end up there. And then they, through their dissatisfaction, decide to get Riskin to rewrite the script. So at any point, if somebody gets what they want, we don't get It Happened One Night, or if we do, it's not as good as it was. But the magic sort of happens, and there are probably hundreds of examples where these same sorts of scenarios played out and the movie wasn't good. But something this particular time worked and made it great. Now, you also have to have talent. You have to have Gable be a good actor. You have to have Colbert be a great actor. You have to have Capra be a great director. Like, there's a certain floor. You can't just take Tommy Wiseau and two folks off the street and expect it happened one night. But even with Tommy Wiseau,
even then you create a cult classic legend forever. And
talk about a flop that ended up doing well later.
Because nobody says that movie's good, but everybody agrees that it's horrible and worth your time. Like you're right. You're absolutely right. There's a chaos going on.
I guess what I'm trying to say is there are things you can do to set up success, right? That if you don't do, you won't get success,
right?
If you have bad actors or the director's just not very good or whatever, there's a certain limit. But once you've hit that limit, then it's kind of up to chance.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes you're a control freak, like you could be a Shining guy. Who made The Shining in 2001 Space Odyssey? What's wrong with me?
Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick. You could be that guy where he was so perfectionist about every point of every project and drove everyone nuts. But you could argue that the films were at least more his vision, if not better movies, because he had that level of control. It's not always going to be true.
You could have full control and make The Phantom Menace.
That's a really good point. See, this is the thing. Like, The Matrix, an amazing first entry. Man, no one talks smack about the first Matrix. What an incredible action film. What a bunch of great ideas. Every little puzzle piece dropped into place where it was supposed to go. Sequels should have been a no-brainer. And I think they're proof that the first one was a magic mess and just worked. And the other two, they tried to do it again and they couldn't do it.
So, I mean, I think Kubrick is a really interesting example because he may be the exception that, I don't know, maybe it proves a rule, maybe it doesn't, but he may be exceptional in that he is a person who could, through sheer force of will, make a good movie somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy.
And I think that's pretty rare. I think Hitchcock is another one of those. Mm-hmm.
That's why we can remember them and we can list them on like five fingers. They're you know, like even...
And other actors like Coppola or other directors like Coppola and Cameron can make great movies, but it's much harder for them to replicate that success.
I agree. Spielberg maybe comes the closest to being able to consistently replicate it and then exceed expectations here and there.
Man. Like, he has his really issues. Look at the breadth of the work.
Oh,
there's unevenness there.
I agree, and there's definitely, I mean, there's some big old weak spots. You know, in particular, like why is Raiders of the Lost Ark so freaking good? And why is Crystal Skull so wrong? Like, that's to me is a fascinating question because you have all the same extremely talented people involved, and yet they just couldn't pull that off. I don't know why that's so interesting to me, but in Spielberg's case, at least he's got a breadth of work that you can point to enough positives to say.
I feel like Capra and Spielberg are very
comparable. Yeah, they're a lot alike. Yeah,
they have a lot of hits. There's a lot of Frank Capra that you can look at and go, oh yeah, great. That one's great. That one's great. That one's great.
They're also tonally very similar. I think their movies are a lot.
They're also for the love of Mike's. yeah, they are. The Capra really was, I mean, Spielberg is the Capra of his day. I should say.
And Sidian reminds us in the chat that Denis Villeneuve has yet to make a bad movie. And I would agree. Let us all go home today and pray to whatever God you have that Dune continues to be well taken care of in his hands.
Can he break the Dune curse? David Lynch couldn't because man. I responded to Rob Hugo, who wrote David Lynch, and I'm like, Dune, right? Mm-hmm. David Lynch has made amazing movies almost every time out. They may not be to your taste,
right?
But they are incredible, except for Dune.
Yeah.
Dune's and I don't even hate Dune. I'm not a Dune hater, but David Lynch doesn't like Dune. No. So, I mean, that he took his name off of it. I think that says it wasn't a complete success for him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, please, Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, I'm so, I have incredible confidence because he hasn't made a bad movie. And not only that, they've all been really diverse and interesting. And he took Blade Runner.
Is he a Kubrick? He just always make it happen somehow.
Maybe. He's that new guy. I really do think in years we'll look back and go, that was one of our guys. That was one of our dudes.
That was the Kubrick of our time. Yeah.
He's incredible. And let's just seriously do all you can to put as many positive vibes out into the world that Dune is good. Okay, everybody? Because we know it's all chaos.
Was Kubrick the Cecil B. DeMille of his
time? Maybe. Maybe. That's one way of putting it. So the movie is It Happened One Night, and I recommend it. It was a fun...
It's a lie. The title is a lie.
Oh, it's a total lie. It happens over like a series
happens
of...
It happens over like 6 or 7 nights.
I think. It's a week and a half or something. But they... Yeah, I don't know why it's called... You know what? I honestly thought the title was a horror movie for years and years and years. I didn't know it was a...
It, well, it kind of has that ring to it,
yeah,
right?
It happened
it
one
happened
night.
It happened one night.
And it sounded like that's what this was until you told me. I went, oh, it's the opposite. Total polar opposite of that. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. In fact, I'm going to be controversial and just say, I think it's my favorite romantic comedy.
There. All, yeah, you know what? I think you'll be real safe with that. If yeah. You've got your answer. This is a gift that we have given ourselves now. And anybody who hasn't watched this, go out and watch it, because It Happened One Night, you can watch. And if somebody says, do you like romantic comedy? Say, I like It Happened One Night.
Yeah, you can say the original, the template, the one that the rest of them copy and to various
like, oh,
levels.
Yeah, I like that. And there's so many more things I don't want to even say. I just want to soak in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just the little motor court that they pull in, which is at the beginning of motels.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the transition. These are, I guess that's one of the things that makes this so timeless, because there are so many things that are brand new in this movie that strike us as old fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of having a motor court that you could pull in and there's no horses, it's just a car, mm-hmm. is relatively new in 1933.
Oh, yeah.
Idea of taking a bus anywhere instead of a train is modern.
Yeah.
It's a new thing.
And everyone's wearing suits and dresses, and it's just a time, and it's the time, and it's time, man. I love
how they get everything done. Too kind of struck me like there's no smartphones here, mm-mm, right? Mm-mm. You got to stop and send a telegraph, send a wire, make a phone call. You got to hope that the person you're calling's at the other end, but you still can do things long distance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just really expensive,
even with just telegraphs and phones.
Yeah. But also it was a reminder that all those conveniences that we have now, like I watch a movie like that, it's kind of painful a little bit, where I'll be like, oh, if you just had a cell phone, this is all fixed. If you had an Uber, you'd be done. You'd be out of here. And then the other part of me says, these people were resilient, man. Like just everyday stuff like that. If you got stuck out in the middle of nowhere and your crappy Ford gave out and your tire went flat, those little skinny tires, like you had to be a tough bugger. And you were out there peeing in your tank or into your radiator and blowing the sweat off your face with your hat. You still had your suspenders and your fancy pants on. And I don't know, there's something about that. There's something rugged about that era, about that time. I don't know what it is, but I always, and you and I are, you know, we've said many times how much we just love the sound of that era. I love the radio of that era. I love the radio dramas of that era. I like the
overacting. That's another one, when they're all singing on the bus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like a thing that people like, not, oh gosh, I wish that guy was shut up.
Yeah,
right?
No, yeah, that
like
was
nobody's sticking headphones in their ears. That's the only music you're going to get on that bus.
And they were into it, man. And then they wanted to join in, and the other guy wanted to take over the next verse, and thinking that is not any, we're so far from that now. And it's not,
and it is, of course, a grave reminder of the dangers of folk singing on a bus, which is why we don't do it anymore, because that bus driver gets too involved, mm-hmm. and crashes.
Yeah. Plus, I would just assume that the hitchhiking would end in somebody putting lotion on the skin, or gets the hose. Like, I don't trust any of that stuff in a
right, like
era.
The worst thing that happens is that the people in the motor court feel like maybe they got bilked for
yes.
a room because Peter left. They don't realize he's coming back.
Yeah.
And it is a Model T, actually.
Is it a Model T? Okay, yeah. That thing was overheating. Right. Was having trouble.
It's also an autogyro.
Oh my gosh.
All helicopters autogyro.
When they said there's an autogyro waiting for you outside, I was like, are you kidding me? I had to pause it. I had to rewind that 10 seconds and just
he's going to land on the lawn in an auto.
Autogyro. Oh, can we call him that now? That'd be fine. This is Bell in the auto gyro. There's
absolutely
traffic on I-15. Yeah. That'd be great.
Oh, look. By the way, auto gyros fill the skies in Los Angeles quite frequently for many reasons. So I will have plenty of opportunities to talk about the traffic. Is that a traffic auto gyro or a police auto gyro?
Yeah, are they chasing a suspect in a crime with that auto gyro?
In a Model T? Is there a Model T chase? by the way, $39.60 when he presents that as the bill, like, works really well now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot more money.
Oh yeah. Back then it was a ton of money.
Back then.
Yeah.
Okay?
Anytime they said like $20 or $25 in this movie, they were talking about me or you saying $500, $600, $700.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
Like that.
So, I mean, I know it's nothing to the rich, you know, father of Ellie, but I was like, wow, $39.60, that's quite a bit of money. Mm-hmm. He's asking for back there.
It's like a down payment on that car of his or less.
Yeah. This entire budget of this movie was $325,000.
That's all?
Yeah.
That was a lot of money then, I guess.
It was. It was quite a bit.
I don't know how you adjust for inflation.
Especially if you're going to have an auto gyro. That's not a cheap shot.
Let's see if this... Actually, I want to do this real quick. Inflation...
Auto gyros weren't regular things. Those were pretty risky things back then.
That's true. You didn't want to be caught in one of those.
By the way, Peter D. Fisher is pointing out, yes, Peter D. Fisher, a helicopter and an auto gyro are not the same thing. An auto gyro has the plane attached with the front prop propeller.
Yeah.
Thanks for raining on our parade.
Yeah. Wah, wah. All right, $39. Oh, wow.
Did you figure it out?
Yeah, I'm going to give this to you right now. That item would cost. Okay, yeah, I was about right. In 1934, if you spent $39 on something and then converted it to today based on this U.S. inflation calculator, $739.84.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
That's a lot.
Not nothing.
No.
That's almost $1,000.
$25 or $24 would be almost $500. And so yeah, your 300,000, let's just do 300, is 5.6 million, which would still be considered right around what you'd pay for for this style of movie today.
Yeah.
You could get away with it.
That feels about right.
Yeah.
Like this, the budget for this movie, given modern sensibilities.
You
get Jennifer Lopez and what's his face? McDreamy from Grey's Anatomy or.
McDreamy. Yep.
Yeah.
He hasn't been on there a while, has he? I don't think he's been on that show.
I don't
think so.
No.
I thought that show was canceled, so I have no room to talk about nothing.
Wicked Kitten 13 wrote in the chat room, "That's what I get paid," but I'm not sure if she's talking about the $5.6 million or
or the 24. I don't know. Anyway, go check it out. It's available for purchase and rent just about everywhere that does that sort of thing. And of course, DVD. I didn't look very hard, but maybe they're Blu-rays as well. But It Happened One Night is a delightful film, and I'm going to make Kim watch it because I think this is like totally up her alley.
Yeah, I'm curious what she would think. I asked Eileen if she wanted to watch it, mm-hmm. and she said, "Who's in it? Jack Lemmon?" And I'm like, "No, that's the 60s sort of homage version. It's Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert." So like, mm-hmm. Never mind.
Oh, too old. Too old, she says.
Too old.
Wow. Yeah, no, I used to have the same aversion and sometimes still do, but this thing we're doing here is actually broaden my what I'm willing to watch, like, or at least take down my normal assumptions about that it's going to be boring or one note or too careful or whatever all my complaints about old Hollywood are. It's been fun to set that aside and see these things for what they are. So
props to Wabbit Magic, by the way, for pointing out something that I was bugging me and I couldn't figure out why Alan Hale is the driver of the car who ends up being a con man.
That's the captain, or that's the...
he's the skipper's father.
Oh, he's the skipper's dad?
Yeah.
Oh, shut up. That's awesome.
The skipper's dad, not even the skipper.
All of which are dead. Everyone's dead in this movie, by the way. I did.
Oh, everyone. That. We didn't even talk about that, yeah. Right.
Long dead. Camera can't even move. Cameramen are all dead. Everyone's dead.
Yeah, Alan Hale's last movie was 1950.
Yeah, Alan Hale Jr. was the skipper.
Alan Hale Jr. was the skipper.
That's a great little piece of... And then, you know what? Now that you say it, I can totally see it. But when he was singing away and looking all dopey, he had a familiarity to him, I guess. I'm a big Skipper fan. I like Gilligan's Island a lot.
You know what? I looked him up in IMDb, and I was like, well, okay, he was in Robin Hood. And, you know, he's a character actor. He's a character actor in a bunch of movies I've seen. But, like, that's not why. It was the fact that he's Alan Hale's Jr.'s father. That's what I didn't put together. Thank you, Wabbit Magic.
That's amazing. Thank you. Like Wabbit, like magic. Wabbit Magic swoops in with a rad piece of trivia. Our next film in the series next month, that'll be in May, will be The Maltese Falcon.
Have you ever seen it?
Bits and pieces, never the full thing. But I remember it being on TV. I remember them holding that sort of, it's, you know, this black and white movie, so it holding this dark statuette thing.
It's one of my favorites. It's up there. I guess I like Humphrey Bogart because this one's up there as one of my favorites. I actually bought Eileen a Falcon in Malta.
Oh, wow.
When I went there on a business trip once.
That's a Maltese Falcon then.
So I will bring it in and I will put it on the, I'll put it behind me.
I remember it being in a glove box. Do I have that memory right? Somebody's car sitting in the glove box for a bunch of time?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It's a MacGuffin. The Maltese Falcon itself is a total MacGuffin. Like there's nothing really important about it.
Right, but you think it is, and it's like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. You're just like, what's this for? And then it turns out to be not the point. But it's a legendary thing, and I'm excited to watch it with adult eyes and actually enjoy it. So that'll be next month, The Maltese Falcon, right here on the Current Geek Film Festival. A reminder that at the end of these shows, on a weekly basis, Legal Geek swoops in and does cool stuff, like this week reviews the consent agreement ending the contentious lawsuit between Grand Theft Auto's developer and a maker of cheating software packages. If you are a gamer or follow that stuff at all, that's a fascinating bit of legalese going on behind the scenes in the gaming industry, so do check that out. That'll be right after we end here with Legal Geek. And before we go, we love your support, and we get it over at Patreon, patreon.com/currentgeek. Super easy to remember. Plunk it into your browser. Boom, you're there. And you can support us simply and easily. If you're like, man, I got a buck here, I could throw it to these guys because I like their show a lot, we'd be super grateful if you did. That again is patreon.com/currentgeek. Tom Merritt, anything else you would like people to know about before we go?
Yes, things. I would like them to know about things, things that are trendy, things that we're noticing in the world around us. You can join us in identifying what's interesting and weird about the world around you on It's a Thing with myself and Molly Wood. Go subscribe right now at itsathing.me.
Nice. I also started a new series of interviews with Chris Metzen. If you are familiar with my previous interviews with
him
on The
Instance. I'm so mad at you for how brilliantly you ended that episode.
It's a pretty good hanger.
Me just salivating for the next one. Genius.
When I got through the edit, I went, oh my gosh, this is a cliffhanger, and I'm going to totally do it. So I did it. Part two coming out real quick, though, so watch for that. But that's happening over at theinstance.net or on the core feed or on the mega feed. So there's three places really to get it in audio form over at frogpants.com. Do check it out if you're interested in a deep dive into the one of the brains who brought us some of the most amazing game experiences of this generation and what he's doing now in his peaceful retirement. Other than that, currentgeek.com is our website. Go over there, check it out. Plenty of stuff to check out. Subscribe to, download, help us out on Patreon, all that stuff. You can leave us an email at currentgeek@gmail.com as well. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we cover the wrap-up to a contentious lawsuit between Take-Two Interactive Software and David Zipperer, a player accused of creating and distributing cheating software for the Grand Theft Auto series. David Zipperer agreed to settle his ongoing litigation with Take-Two this past week, essentially admitting all fault and paying an undisclosed sum of money to Take-Two for his actions. Zipperer worked with a team in the US and Europe to develop and distribute several pieces of software that allowed GTA players to cheat while playing those games, including software known as Menu and Absolute. Take-Two sued Zipperer and claimed these cheats created unauthorized derivative works of GTA, thereby making them copyright infringement. Take-Two also claimed that Zipperer tortuously interfered with the contracts made between Take-Two and other players, while also breaching the end-user license agreement himself. We've discussed EULAs before on this segment and how they can be very difficult to enforce, but against egregious conduct like what was alleged here, it's still possible to use that EULA to defend a software developer's rights. The consent agreement signed by both parties after the settlement was reached states that Zipperer agrees that he committed all these acts, including the copyright infringement and tortious interference with contract, in exchange for agreeing to an injunction stopping all further development and distribution of cheat software and the aforementioned undisclosed amount of money. Zipperer gets out of this expensive and contentious lawsuit before it goes to full trial. So in this case, Take-Two won, but only after considerable cost and effort in court to get to this consent agreement. One factor that probably helped lead these parties to settle was how hostile the judge had become in recent months over the conduct of both sides' attorneys. The judge was openly critical of Take-Two asking overbroad questions in discovery and delaying the process to get to trial, alleging that Take-Two was trying to bury the defendant under an unreasonable amount of pretrial filings and discovery requests. The judge also accused Zipperer's attorney of not dealing with some of Take-Two's discovery inquiries in good faith, calling this attorney the greater sinner in this case. So at the end of the day, Zipperer and his legal team must have figured the potential loss was going to be worse at trial then whatever the agreement turned out to be. Plus everyone, including the irate judge, gets to move on from this case. The bottom line is, companies like Take-Two, with wildly successful game lines like Grand Theft Auto, have the resources needed to actually enforce EULAs against bad actors like David Zipperer. Go figure, the maker of a game encouraging digital fantasy crime is the one to stop a developer of cheating software. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.